This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Before we head into the long weekend, we're taking a look back on education stories we've covered over the course of 2015. Today, we'll be hearing interviews on the Higher Education Blueprint, how to integrate students with special needs into the education system, as well as inclusive education. First up, though, we begin the show with Teach for Malaysia, Zamir Zulkifli, who spoke to Live and Learn's producer, Chua Eun Teck, about the work his social enterprise has been doing since 2010 to address education inequality.
So in Malaysia, we're starting off with a slightly different data point as well. We're actually using what the ministry and together with Pemandu ranked all the schools based on academic performance. This is where you hear about the high-performing schools in Malaysia. So we go to the opposite end of that spectrum. We hope to change it and move it to a lot more about the child's background, like either free school meals or income of the parents. But that data is very hard and hasn't been standardized that well in Malaysia. I think from our perspective as well, like while we haven't seen any alumni, like that's what we call those that graduate, actually complain yet, it might come. But what's important is that during the 2 years is to always listen to feedback. Mm. To take on that feedback as well and incorporate it to make our program always better. And that's the values that we expect them to live as well as teachers teaching kids. Mm. Whatever plan you come up with, you will face frustrations working with students or high-performing fellows. And it's all about listening and tweaking it, but keeping the main goal alive.
So the number of applicants to your programs have been increasing every year. Is there a danger of fellows displacing more able and experienced teachers in schools?
In Malaysia, it's a bit tricky because the only time a teacher leaves the system is when they retire or when they opt to leave themselves. So we don't actually have an exit policy for existing teachers based on performance in Malaysia. What is more of a risk in Malaysia itself is actually Teach Malaysia fellows are competing with other incoming teachers. And then how do you make that differentiation about that? So I think that's where we hope that either a competency-based interview would stand the test to differentiate what the differences are, but for both of them would be untested at that point.
Wouldn't it create a lot of bureaucracy because the teachers under TFM would have a separate evaluation process?
The evaluation process, I mean, we do that internally. We select and then we propose to the Ministry of Education how to evaluate. I mean, then it goes through the ministry's evaluation, so which is standardized for all teachers. Mm-hmm. So we just, in a way, any Teach Malaysia fellow goes through almost double screening in that sense. Mm. But in classrooms, the biggest difference is the level of support. And I think that, which is what we're trying to encourage overall, not just for just our fellows, but for all teachers. You're new on the job, or even though you've been there for 5 years, you need the support, you need a third party to be guiding and coaching you to be a better teacher in the classroom, mm-hmm. To reflect more. Because once you're teaching in the classroom, you can't suddenly step back and say like, oh, maybe I wasn't talking to this kid a bit more, or maybe I didn't push this child enough in that sense. So it's that level of support that really differentiates.
So how do you find the right school or the right fit for the fellows?
For us, we have to work with the Ministry of Education, so we have very little control over about the final school that we go into, beyond that it's a high-need school. So once we get into a school, the first key important point is that we need to recruit the right fellows. No matter what universities they come from, they need to have a high level of humility, respect, and empathy. They need to understand that they're going into a school not as the saviors, but as just colleagues, working with other teachers that are just as motivated to teach the kids. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the first part. The second part is then just Teach Malaysia comes in as an organization, and we try to talk to the principals, the senior staff members, for them to understand what we're trying to achieve, and then work together to collaborate to further develop and support the fellows. And when all of us are aligned around making an impact for students, there's very few differences in that sense.
What is the end goal of this? Is it to raise the test scores of the school, or are you trying to convert the high-need school into a high-performing school?
Yeah, that's always been a very, very hard question to answer. And there's a lot of routes that go there. There's also like, should we send our kids to universities, or should we send them to vocational training? What is the end goal? And when I come down to it, and one answer, one question at least that helps me answer this, like that I heard 2 years ago that I use till today, is that if you were a parent, would you be nervous if your child was randomly placed in any 10,000 school in Malaysia, of the schools in Malaysia? And if the answer is yes, I will be nervous, then we haven't done our job. Because we need to eliminate the fact that schools give children different opportunities in that sense.
That was Zamir Zulkifli from Teach for Malaysia speaking to Live and Learn producer Chua and Tech. Now also working to make education more equitable in Malaysia is Datuk Dr. Siti Zaleha, who began her 35-year career at the Ministry of Education as a teacher, and then she subsequently held various positions as a policymaker overlooking teacher training colleges and the textbook division, among others. Datuk Siti was commissioned by the United Nations Development Programme to write a chapter in the Malaysia Human Development Report about inclusive education. She explains her findings to Mira Sivasodhi.
Dr. Siti, just before I go back, I know you also wrote a report in 2012-2013, and that looked purely on inclusive education. But what do you mean by inclusive education or inclusive growth in this context in 2014?
When you look at education, you have to look at it in totality. You cannot look at it independently of others as well. I feel you should also look at it in terms of the labour market as well. Because the end of education, we can go by education for education's sake, it's fine. But we do know that education is actually also, something that you need in order to be employed, to be employable. So when you talk about inclusive education, it means everybody, anyone and everyone who's a citizen of this country should be given education. And, this time we can report that we have done that very well. We want everybody, every child, everywhere to be in education from preschool now. We've gone to preschool. It's a recent development, no doubt, but preschool has always been there, but a paid one. Now it airs a public preschool opportunity. So we are increasing the years in which our children, citizens of this country, are in education. They are well educated. We already have adult literacy, for instance, at the moment standing at 93%, which is very high in this region. And we have 99% of children enrolling into primary education. And it's increasing now with preschool, which is also publicly funded. Therefore, as far as access to education is concerned, there's a lot of success there. We have enable everybody to get access to education. The other concern that the ministry raised was equity, in the sense that there's every likelihood that a child in the urban area will get access to better education than those in the rural area. Having said that, of course, you also have the urban disadvantage. So equity, either in the urban disadvantage or in the rural areas, is there. And therefore, how do we ensure, enable that every child gets that education and as much education as possible? Recently also, we have figures to show that a lot of children now stay in school until the STPM, post-SPM. So they stay on into pre-university level. So either they go into STPM or other providers that provide post-form 5 education at various colleges and various certifications. So we know that the population is actually being very, very well educated. The equity question again comes into the question about those who have and those who have not. Those who have, meaning who are economically better off, will stay in education longer, will be able to have schools of their choice, locally and abroad. And with the liberalisation of education, we find that a lot of children now go into private education, right from primary into secondary into post-secondary as well. This is actually causing concern among certain quarters. Again, the question of equity, because people often equate that private education equals quality education and public education is less so. But so the question of equity again comes with this perception about private and public education, and those who can afford will be able to get the best, and those who cannot afford will have to just go through the national system.
But that shouldn't be the case.
That should not be the case.
It wasn't the case.
It was not the case. But the scholarships that were there for all students to go into either public or private education are getting less and less, as you were. So the number, I feel that this is because the number of students staying in education has actually exceeded the amount, the funding that's available to the students to take up so that they can go into universities of their choice. But this is it. Inclusive education to me also means that students, especially post-secondary students, should be able to do the courses and the disciplines that they want to, rather than taking a second best, a second choice. A second choice because that's all that the universities have a place for. It's not because they don't qualify, but because the numbers are limited. For instance, medicine, we know that it's oversubscribed. Certain courses are definitely oversubscribed. And so you're offered courses that are not sexy. Not on your first choice and second choice, sometimes third choice.
I mean, you said 99% of our children are in primary education. Access doesn't necessarily equate to quality. Wouldn't you agree with me?
I would agree.
And we're lacking in terms of quality. And the sort of students we find coming out of SPM and, you know, or STPM and universities, and I mean, they're unable to get employment. Mm-hmm. There's something wrong with the system.
Employability is a factor when you say that children have gone through education for 10 years, for 13 years, for 15 years. At the end of the day, you'd hope that they would come up skillful and employable somewhere. And that their talent, their potentials are there. But how does the system help them? And where should the intervention be? Primary education, preschool, primary education is pretty basic. Knowing your three R's, if it were to simplify. Of course, it's much more complex than that. And then you have the secondary education. There's a lot to be said about a curriculum that should instill in our children skills, thinking skills, because we cannot know the jobs that's available for them in 5 years down the road. Who would know? Who would have thought that IT was such a big? It's going to be a big thing, but we never had that. We never thought about that, and we never had that in our system. So, right now, we should learn from that in the sense that we should prepare our children for work that's not identified yet, for employment that's in areas that we have not identified. So this is where post-secondary should look into courses that have what potentials in the future. Should not limit ourselves to just the traditional courses that we have right now. For instance, if you look at the media courses that we have here and IT sources, it's not IT engineering. It's all about creative IT, for instance. And there's a lot of market out there. But somehow, along the way, we've not got enough courses. We have the talent pool, but we don't have enough universities, privately or publicly, offering that to our children, for instance. And then we also, in the sense that there's also a limited market. So it's a chicken or the egg thing. Universities would prepare or have courses that will support the job market, if you like. But there are certain courses that simply is not available because, again, the educators, the lecturers are not there. Who's going to teach our children about media, for instance, about IT? Because it was never there, you know? And so it's new courses have got to be generated.
Well, we need to be versatile, isn't it?
So the education system, right from beginning to tertiary education, has got to prepare students to be flexible, to be versatile, to be talented. So we really need to study the curriculum that we have, especially at the tertiary level.
And what about the children with disabilities, be it learning or physical disabilities. I think there are a group of children who eventually are going to be adults and who can also contribute to the economy and completely not looked at seriously enough. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
We have a lot of voluntary organizations that looked into people with this kind of disadvantages. Again, from conversations with friends who volunteer or who are involved with this kind of volunteerism, says that there isn't enough organizations and systematicity in preparing people to deal with, to manage, to deal, to educate people with this with various disabilities.
But we cannot depend on philanthropy.
We cannot, definitely. So there is no system, as it were, to organize, to just doesn't seem to be any will, political will. Mm-hmm. Maybe some in the policy, but not enough to translate the mass that we require. So a lot still depends till this day on volunteerism. And the training of people to deal with this is very specialized. I was in certain teacher training college before, and I find that in a particular class, for instance, for visual impairment, one teacher is only can deal only with five students. So it's very intensive. In schools, for instance, they used to have inclusiveness in the sense that the disabled child, visual impairment, for instance, would sit with the other children. But you would have a specialist teacher who will then go with the children, with the child, and work through the lesson with that child after the class. So this is a very intensive work. It's on one-to-one. So how many do we require, you know, in order to support this kind of disabilities? So there needs to be a political will to deal with this kind of impairment.
And it goes back to the education system. I mean, you need to provide these courses in public universities so that you have experts coming out to look at the sector in which there is a dire need for teachers, and especially teachers who are able to teach children with special needs.
Indeed. For example, we've done it before with, for example, before we did not have this childhood education.
Preschool,
which will then, you know, enable the teachers to deal with preschool. But once there was a need for it, there was a concerted effort by the universities to have these courses. And they did, and they are successful. So now, as I explained to you earlier, there are already preschools in public schools as much as in private schools. Therefore, if there is a concerted effort and a kind of to begin the courses at this at these institutions, then I feel that, you know, we will deal with that matter, manage the matter better, and allow the people who have got these disabilities to contribute to the economy.
That was Mira Sivasodi speaking to Datuk Dr. Siti Zaleha about the challenges facing our education system. After the break, we hear from Joshabet Isaacs on how we can integrate students with special needs into our existing system. You're listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. If you've just joined us, today we're looking back at education stories we've covered in 2015. Special needs education is one of the major pillars that requires improvement as identified by the Malaysian Education Blueprint released in 2013. As part of this initiative, teachers within the Ministry of Education have been undergoing training to facilitate the integration of students with special needs into national schools. Joshabet Isaacs is a clinical psychologist and one of the trainers. She told me what it will take to make this initiative successful. Joshabet, at this point, do you think Malaysian schools or the Malaysian system is prepared for something even, you know, close to what the US system has?
I think at this point, I mean, even from our discussion today, you know, the scene, I think, in Malaysia, Dr. Nan, is it's very much pioneered by parents like Madam Sue here of a child with special needs. And a lot of the pioneers, I think, in special education belong to the NGOs, people with really great hearts and, you know, and families and people who want to help out. Overall, though, I think that there is a, there is still areas to develop in terms of the understanding of the need for governance, training, qualities, standards and policies when it comes to special education. So let's say 10 years ago, you know, it would be very volunteer-based. It's not like taken in the same seriousness, let's say, as a medical doctor or medical conditions where you need to have clear training, clear qualifications. Right. You can't just start a practice or a clinic without fulfilling these requirements. Yes. So I think based on that, we are quite, we still have a lot of way to go. I think when it comes to, let's say, school, it's really, it's a mindset of how important and valuable is special education. And if once that mindset is set, then all the moves will start to happen based on budgeting, resource. I mean, our classroom sizes itself, 40 children per class is really too large.
Yeah.
And I think even our typical children, a lot of them need support in the sense of tuition after school. Yeah. So what more a child with special needs? We find that it's hard for that to be a really successful environment for them based on classroom sizes, based on the teachers' limited attention because of lack of resource, based on the bilingual language. They already have a difficulty with language. So learning multiple languages at the same time will be a challenge.
It's a beautiful idea to think that, you know, people with special needs could work alongside everybody else, you know, without there being any indication of difference. But here, I think even in our schools, we might struggle to see that, you know, children may still be treated differently, whether by their peers or even by adults, you know. So how do we get to that point where there is social integration, where people can kind of sit next to somebody with autism in a classroom and not tease them or, you know, not have that problem?
One of the things that we want to do next year with our 10-year anniversary or celebrating our 10 years in Malaysia is to actually run an acceptance campaigns in schools. So in our 10 years, we find working with private and international schools, that's more of where our children have transitioned to and inclusion has been more successful in private and international schools. So we plan to have these acceptance campaigns where basically a supervisor from our company would actually go in and have a session with the children, whether it's a small classroom or whether it's the full assembly, but actually talking about celebrating differences. And they won't just be specific about autism, but it will be about general things like the color of our skin, the hair, our hair color, our hair texture, the food that we eat, the languages that we speak. And on that note, with languages that we speak, that some children may not yet be confident with speaking. So they may require a bit of a prompt, or they may require a bit of a nudge to communicate, or they may require an iPad to communicate or an augmentative device to communicate efficiently. But then we also want to then build in children from a young age, so the younger the better, a tolerance, an acceptance, a compassion. And the reality is my dad growing up, he did that for my family. So from a young age, whether it's 4 years old, 7 years old, at every point we were taught to volunteer, we were taught to care for others. And I think that's why we are all in similar fields of this sort of career of choice, because that has been inculcated. So it is disappointing to hear sometimes schools have confided and said that sometimes it's difficult to accept a special needs child because other parents of typically developing children may complain or may say, you know, why are there special children? I don't want my child to be associated. But I don't think that's the right attitude in a community. I think that we should take care of society. And so other families may have this difficulty with their child with special needs. We should help support that as a community that's caring and accepting. And one way is to volunteer, like to actually teach our kids to celebrate differences, to accept and to help. So a friend of mine, her daughter, they live in Australia. And when they came back, the little girl, 10 years old, I said, I work with autism. She perked up and she said, autism? I have a friend with autism in my class. And I went, oh, really? She said, yeah. Sometimes she gets really upset and she might hit at me. So then I just have to tell her, hey, calm down, you know. So this little 10-year-old girl is telling me how she prompts her friend. And then she says how sometimes my friend may not respond to me. So I have to like point at her or tap her a few times to get her attention. So she's telling me this. So just like how Sesame Street has just launched, right? Yep. We've been talking about this
at
EAP.
At least two videos, yep.
And a full social story and a character called Julia who has autism. And Elmo is talking about Julia and talking about the difficulties Julia has, but how you can actually respond to her. So it's creating in children an ability to, hey, that girl is different or that boy is different. He may not talk as confidently, but he can still be my friend, which will address the teasing, the bullying, you know, because you become more caring. Yeah.
So looking at where our schools are, we also need good teachers. Are there enough teachers in Malaysia for special needs children?
Based on our last, you know, discussion, I think they mentioned that there's only 1,000 teachers that are trained in special education or with some background in special ed. So I don't think that will be sufficient because even, I think if I'm not mistaken, the Putrajaya unit for the special education classes that they have, they only have, I think, a ratio of 4 trained adults. Whereas, like, I think the schools in that district, as well as all the one-to-one meetings and all that, it totals it to about 400 children. So that definitely is not sufficient because just in terms of attention, because the reality is to run a good special education program, you require individual attention. And you can't do that with so many children to a person. The ratio has to be realistic. So at, let's say with us, we have a guideline of about 10 children to one supervisor because you just, your mind space, you have to be able to give the attention, give the focus and give the time to actually observing every area of development that the child has. So if we have 7 areas of program from early learner skills, academic skills, daily living skills, social skills, play skills, all of that has to be broken down to their component parts. It's pretty intense and it's very intentional. So I think when it comes to autism, the reality is that we've actually sort of passed the experimental stage of what works, what works, what works. I don't think that is as much a mystery anymore. Mm-hmm. There is research-based programs that it's like we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Yeah. We know the wheel works. That's what we need to move.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with autism. ABA works. I think if we can actually bring that to Malaysia and make that more accessible to families, we really hope that will be something that will help many more people. We feel that everyone in Malaysia, children with autism, deserve the right to receive quality ABA.
That was Joshebed Isaacs explaining the challenge of mainstreaming special needs education in Malaysia. Now, our final story of the day concerns the Blueprint for Higher Education, which was released in March. Associate Professor Dr. Jaffar Jantan from the Higher Education Department within the MOE spoke to Meera Sivasodhi about the Blueprint's 11-year roadmap to improve the quality of local graduates.
Ever since the country, at least for the higher education, we adopted the approach of the outcomes-based education. We were trying to move away from the so-called content-based education. And the reason why we moved from content-based to outcomes-based education was because the whole world was moving in that direction. And for the professional programs, for example, engineering and many other professional programs, they had been required to perform or to undergo the so-called process of accreditation. And for accreditation and for any program to be given accreditation, they must change their approach from content to outcomes. So what is the difference between content and outcome? If you recall during your undergraduate years where you always come to a class and there is this so-called portfolio for the class and you look at topics that you will be covering every week and topics and content and topics and content. So basically that focuses for your attainment on the content for the topics outlined for each of the courses. And sometimes you don't even see the relationship between a course that you take today in this year and the course that you are taking again in the next year and the next semester and the following semesters. There is no strong link between these courses. As a result of this, many parts of the world had decided perhaps what we ought to do based on the fundamental theories of teaching and learning. They went back and observed that many students are not learning based on this content-based approach. So they moved on to a different approach, which is outcomes. You define your culminating outcomes clearly before even thinking on what courses and what topics to even teach. And so outcomes based started that way, and they say that have a vision, have a mission, and then you say, upon completion of this program, what can the students be able to do? So now you are looking at the capabilities of the students being competent upon completion of the program. And in order for the students to be competent, be able to do all of this, what are the courses that can help to support their development? What are the topics for each course that support this development? So this whole idea brings us back to what we need to change. And we decided that we need to change the curriculum. And that curriculum must then help the students to develop not only the academic performances, as we all know, the knowledge and understanding and perhaps the skills for that particular program, but more so the transferable skills. People call it generic skills, transferable skills. Talking about the ability to work as a team member. Can the students now, upon completion of the program, provide leadership? Can they communicate, converse? Can they be proficient in a couple of languages? Mm-hmm. Can they be cogent enough so that when they speak, someone out there in the audience will not say, I could not understand what you are saying? All the processes that are built within the curriculum and outside of the curriculum is supposed to develop the students. And more so after that, how do we report that the students have achieved all these attributes that we desire of them from the curriculum design?
So how would we, this is taking off already in 2015, this year?
This is already taking off. For the past couple of years, programs such as engineering has been doing this, except that the way that they report the students' performance does not really entail to the reporting of what we plan to do in the integrated CGPA. It is still the same grade that you see, and the transcript would then still report on the credits for the course, the name of the courses, the grade that the students get every semester, the CGPA and whatnot. But with the integrated CGPA, in addition to all the information, you still have the name of the course, you still have the credit hours taken for each course, and you still have the grades for each course. What additional information we would like to put in this transcript is the so-called the integrated CGPA in the form of a spider web.
And five universities are involved in this?
For the moment, yes, five universities are piloting it. And we will see how the universities are doing. In fact, they are doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them just could not wait. Many private universities just, JJ, I couldn't wait for this. This is not fair. I would also like to become one of those pilot universities.
And this will be, you will sort of reevaluate in 2018?
We are going to look at this first by the end of this semester, because we are still developing. Some of the things that we had been using, we had been developing, may need to change to accommodate for problems and challenges that these five universities are facing. But basically, one of the most important things that we also need to address is like your, you know, you may have addressed this before. JJ, how do you measure the soft skills of the students?
Exactly.
You talked about
how
leadership.
How do you do that?
Yeah, you talked about leadership. You talked about teamwork. For God's sake, you think it's easy for the students? They're not going to be able to perform out there in the real world. So how do you measure so that they can become employable? This is all what we all want to do. This is what the employers have been saying. Our students is not capable of communicating, provide leadership, not resilient enough, not responsible enough. So how do courses help the students develop these skills? Basically, how do you measure it? Measurement is not by using a yardstick or a meter rule. Measurement in this case have to go back to the assessment tasks that you provide for the students to experience. What I'm trying to say, for example, just as an example, you're giving the students a project, say you're going to go to a village nearby, you're going to mix with the people in the village. Your outcome will be happiness among the village people, increased knowledge among the village people, increased unity among the village people. Those are the outcomes from your immersion program with the village people. So how do I measure that? Well, number one, the villages will have to assess the students. Among the students, they will be assessing themselves. And then they will be assessing each other. And then a few observers from the universities who are conducting this course would also observe. So we're talking about 360 degrees evaluation.
At the moment, it's only, what, 300 students affected?
Total number of students varies from universities and faculties. Basically, we are targeting about 300 students. But I do believe from the last count, we do have about 400 over students who will be involved in this pilot study.
Considering we have 20 public institutions, this is a very small sample. Were you afraid to go on a wider scale?
The ministry believes that all universities desires to have this. But in order to have optimized result, we are trying to ensure universities are in the know, have the capacity. The learning faculties, the teaching faculties also know how to engage in the design of the curriculum, in teaching of the 21st century, in creating rubrics so that when you assess, you are not obsessed with numbers like we do today, you know. So these are some of the things that we need to help us to develop in the teachers, in the lecturers at the university and the managers of the university first. So after the end of this first semester, we're going to look back what worked in terms of developing the teachers and the lecturers at the university and changing the curriculum.
How do you manage it? Because this is over and above the academic side of things. So all of the time is taken into consideration as well, how much they're going to be spending on academics as well as how much they're going to be developing their soft skills.
Are we talking about the lecturers? Are we talking about
the students?
Okay. As far as the students are concerned, their development, if you had designed the curriculum from the very beginning, even before the students come and enroll for the program, you would have already mapped out in a process that is called constructive alignment. And in the process of constructing the curriculum, we have already determined that for each course, if the course is 1 credit hour, the students' learning time or engagement time with the content and the learning experiences and the assessment task and the whatnot constitute to 40 hours of their time. So once you have designed it that way, then it is fair for you. All courses that are 3 credit hour courses means students will only be committing 120 hours of their time. Anything more and less, a little bit more or less, it's okay. But if it's too much, then we have to go back and look into how we can make it better.
That was Mira speaking to Professor Dr. Jaffa Jantan from the Ministry of Education about the Higher Education Blueprint. Next week, we continue our review with highlights from January to March. You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.